Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast is brought to you by Stock Market Hats. Stock Market Hats claim to be stylish and funny. Frankly, I wasn't that amused by some of them, but maybe you will be. And it's not just hats either, but they have t-shirts, sports bras, socks, and even pet ID tags. It's worth checking out, and right now you can take advantage of a 10% discount on all merchandise. Go to stockmarkethats.com and enter the code CONTRARIAN before you check out and take advantage of this special offer. There is a referral link I will put in the show notes as well. Stock Market Hats, claiming to be stylish and funny. Very proud here to have David Hunter of Contrarian Macro Advisors back on the podcast. Welcome back, David. Very excited to hear your updates on markets. You've been very prescient with your views here, calling for, and you even gave us targets of the S&P 4,500. You said the Dow would hit 36 and that the NASDAQ would hit 15,000. Those have all been reached. And I want to quiz you and get your update here because you are now calling for a pullback and that will then be followed by the final melt-up, the final parabolic portion, I believe, of the melt-up, which will conclude before a big pullback next year. So very curious on hearing your thoughts on that.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on, Nathaniel. And yeah, I guess it's been a while since we've talked because I've raised targets a few times since that 4,500. I'm now on the S&P at 5,300, wow. 42,000 on the Dow, 18,000 on the NASDAQ, and 2,900 on the Russell 2000. So we've got a ways to go, but we're getting a lot closer. This latest run has taken the Russell out of a year-long consolidation. It has broken out. So I think for a lot of people, the fact that it was going nowhere all year had them bearish and couldn't understand why I thought, you know, the small caps would ultimately outperform the big caps. But now that we've broken out, I think people are getting on board. That thing will run. But you're right. I do think it's not necessarily going to happen. The shorter term is much harder to call.
And yeah.
But there was a setup there that says that we could see a pullback of maybe 4 to 6%. We've moved farther than I thought we would in the last week. I talked about a pullback last week and said it was coming. I didn't mean it was going to come imminently that day or the next day, but it's, you know, it has moved out of, you know, it's broken out to new highs. So now it begs the question, is that pullback still in place? I think we're a bit ahead of ourselves here. So I still think there's some sort of pullback coming. We may not see it this week, but I think certainly in coming days. But that's not the big story. The really big story is that I think a melt-up is getting underway and that it's a final melt-up. We've really been in a melt-up for a year, but a final melt-up leg, I think, is getting underway and will take us to those levels. And I actually think my current targets are still too low.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So 5,300 on the S&P, that's another upside of at least 15 to 18%, if my quick maths are correct. So yeah, I mean, the pullback, I mean, what could maybe possibly cause that? Because we've had earnings this quarter have been very good, beating estimates. And then we had the Fed yesterday with a mostly dovish meeting, I guess. The tapering of bond purchases was widely anticipated, and they have mostly punted on raising interest rates right now and probably for the next, you know, 6 to 9 months. But so what could potentially cause the pullback here? Because also we had a big pullback in September.
Yeah, it really doesn't take much. You know, it's just a technical 3 to 5% type move. So anything can kind of disrupt the market for a few days. But mostly what I see now that just has me saying, I doubt that we just keep going here. It's just that all of a sudden everybody thinks November and December are seasonally strong and it's going to go straight to the end. So it can just be some little thing. Could be a Fed comment. It could be something over in China. Could be, you know, something, you know, Europe, could be UK raising rates, you know, anything like that could cause people, and certainly could be a data release, because we still are in that period that started this summer where the economy has slowed down. So you're still going to be getting, you know, disappointing numbers, I think, on some of those things, housing or retail or what have you. But it's really the big story is that it's only a, you know, a short-term stair step down on the way to a much higher high. Right. So I, you know, I would not try to trade it.
Right.
I do see still some things, particularly on the industrial side, that those stocks have lagged here short-term and look like they could roll over and give you, you know, that kind of 5% pullback. So maybe it's not going to happen, but I still think the setup is there to say it's potentially there.
Okay. So overall bullish, but interestingly here, you also have some views sector-wise, and you say oil stocks have peaked. And is that intermittent or does that include this final melt-up that we would get?
Yeah, I think we have seen the peak in oil for this cycle. And okay. I said that starting a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it took a little while. People were, you know, when it didn't happen immediately, people were starting to say, you're wrong. It's going to 90, it's going to 100, it's going higher. Because it was, you know, I called it at 84.5, went down to maybe 84 again, 83, 84, and then went back up towards 85. And they thought it was on its way again. It, you know, contrarian calls are not meant to be immediate that day. It's saying we're very close. And certainly a cycle call is not going to be something I can hit on the day or the next day.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But now that it has kind of started to weaken, I see enough in there to say, yeah, I think we've seen the highs in oil for the cycle and also the highs for the oil sector stocks. XLE, for example, looks like next step down could take it down, you know, 10 to 15%. So, yeah, everybody kind of got excited because of the momentum in oil in the last month or two. Obviously, gasoline prices have moved way up and oil's moved up. I think it was a bit of what I call extrapolation fever. You know, people just jump on the momentum bandwagon and they kind of double discount what's already in the market. So, you know, my view is we are going to see a bust. I pushed it out a bit where it's probably more of a second half 2022 story. But in that bust, it will, and it's a global bust, it will really hit demand hard in oil. And I think you could see oil back into the 20s, you know, 25 or high 20s from here. So not going to get there in the next few months. I think you're going to see this thing bounce around, could get down into the 60s and then back up and then, you know, work its way lower over the course of the next 6 or 9 months. But I do think the high watermark has probably been seen.
Interesting. And you say that despite we do have some secular tailwinds for oil and energy, you know, we have all these supply chain issues and demand is very strong, but you don't think that's enough to move things higher?
No, again, these markets are discounting mechanisms.
Right.
So they're discounting. I was very bullish of oil up through the mid to high 70s. And then I got off the bandwagon and said it's going far enough for me. It pushed beyond that to the mid-80s for a very short spike. You know, it wasn't up there very long. But you know, that's markets discount ahead. And what we see among investors, both institutional and retail investors, is they tend to look at the price today and use today's fundamentals to justify higher prices. Mm-hmm. That's already in the stocks. Now, if the fundamentals continue and we don't see, you know, oil impacted and supply stays so tight, I could be wrong and it could go higher. But I, right now, what I see fundamentally and technically gives me confidence to say the odds favor this thing working lower, not higher.
All right. Okay, let's talk about next year then and the bust, which, are you still saying that this is going to be caused by the Fed and by potentially a Fed overreaction?
Yeah, ultimately, when the cycle ends, and this is, again, global, so the Fed's a piece of it and all central banks are, but ultimately, when the cycle ends, I think it will end because the Fed tightens. And what I think is not easy to understand, in investors and traders tend to see things happening very immediate, but inflation is likely to heat up here further. The momentum behind inflation is strong. That's going to ultimately force Fed to speed up the taper and move to tightening, I think, sooner than they would expect. And then the thing that I think people don't always understand, and you know, I lived through the early 80s as an investor, as an institutional investor, so I remember it well. Inflation, once it breaks out like that, is not easy to tame. So it's not just a matter of, you know, the Fed saying we're going to tighten now and they hike rates and inflation just stops on a dime. They're going to tighten, look, inflation is going to keep running. They're going to tighten again, look. And so they won't know that they've over tightened until after the fact. Yeah. And the other half of the equation is that we have a extremely highly leveraged system globally, not just here. And we have a fragile system because of the pandemic. And when you add those two things together with the tightening, I think the equation equals out to a bust.
Yeah. But you don't think that it'll happen, any tightening or adjustment of bond purchases beyond what's been announced until the middle of next year or so?
I don't know if it'll be sooner than that, but it certainly won't be in the next few months. So I think probably through the first quarter, you're going to see the expected taper. But I think as you move into the second quarter, it's just a guess at this point as to when inflation crosses over a point, where Powell and the Fed say, we can't just ignore this anymore. So it really depends on what we see in the next 3 or 4 months. But my guess is, if anything, they're going to have to, you know, stop taper sooner and begin tightening sooner, which if I were targeting, it'd be sometime in the second quarter.
Second quarter. Okay. So before June 30th. Now, is this going to be Powell making that call, or is it somebody else going to replace him? Any thoughts on that?
Good question. Yeah. If they do what they should do, if Biden does what he should do, Powell should be reappointed. You know, I was a big critic of Powell all prior to the pandemic. He had a rough start to how you communicate Fed policy and what he needed to do. But he's been a rapid learner. And I would say, in spite of all the criticism, he's done a very good job through the pandemic and has shown a calming force when not all his governors were so calm. I think that's one of the big mistakes that's been made in certainly the last decade, is allowing every governor that wants his face out there to, you know, come out with his own opinion. But it's still Powell's Fed. So if Biden's smart, he'll reappoint him, and it takes one of, he's not having an easy time of it as president. This would be one place where if he did that, it'd take one thing he had to pay a lot of attention to off the table. However, you know the story too. There's questions of whether the progressives really want to push Brainard, and is Lyle Brainard going to get the job? I think that would be a big mistake, but who knows?
Because she's too dovish, or?
Yeah, she's very dovish, and I think the Fed, has been plenty dovish. But I think you do have to still balance the two. If she got into the role, maybe she'd take on a more responsible role. Understand she has to kind of balance the two risks. But at least in her kind of any comments she makes or her votes. She seems to be very much to the, you know, the dovish side, and she'd also be more beholden to the progressive left mm-hmm. in terms of modern monetary theory, et cetera, which I think is a joke.
Mm-hmm. And what about the governors they would then appoint? Because there's a couple of them stepping down, if I'm not mistaken. How does that even work? I don't even know. Do they appoint them, or how, I guess they come from the individual
bad banks? Yeah, depends. Some come from the regional banks, presidents of regional banks. Some are appointed depending on the role, you know, the position that's leaving the Fed. So you probably have some of both coming. I have a feeling the Fed makeup is going to move more dovish. And that's okay. But you really need that strong leader that I do think Powell is that guy. So hopefully he gets reappointed, but, you know, we won't know for probably a couple months.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
This episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast brought to you by Stock Market Hats. Stock Market Hats claim to be stylish and funny. Some of them say things like end the Fed, don't tax the rich, I heart the Fed, Dr. Parik Patel, not back office. Okay, that one is actually kind of funny. Market cap, that's also pretty funny. And some other ones. You may know their Twitter at Stock Market Hats, but check it out, stockmarkethats.com, and enter Contrarian at checkout to take advantage of a 10% discount. We have central banks around the world withdrawing QE, and some are starting to tighten. Although the Bank of England this morning, they passed again. They said they were going to wait another month. Norway last week, or maybe whenever it was, said they're going to raise. New Zealand raised last month. But do you think that any of that could increase the pressure on the Fed? How do these things work? The Fed claims they don't watch any of that, but of course they do. And of course, currencies move. Do you think that'll impact things and force the Fed to
handle more? Worldwide monetary policy is something they pay close attention to. Mm-hmm. I don't care what they say. And certainly Australia's had a spike in rates recently, too. So it's not just New Zealand. I do think there's a possibility, because of the weakness we had in the third quarter, that it takes a little bit of the pressure off around the world, this idea that we have to hike rates very quickly here. However, I do think if supply chain issues begin to resolve, that was the big hit to the third quarter. You know, autos, obviously the chip shortage is hitting autos very hard, and there's just no supply out there to get the sales. So I think that was probably the biggest part of the third quarter weakness. If that picks up in the fourth quarter, then, you know, you're going to have more pressure on. If, however, the supply chain issues persist and auto supply inventory can't meet demand and so you lose sales, then I think, you know, there's a possibility that you might actually find the central bank saying, gee, we kind of jumped the gun here, and maybe rate hikes aren't as close as we thought. So a lot depends, I think, on supply chain here in the next few months.
What about China? There's weird stuff going on there. I mean, Evergrande, they seem to have now maybe dodged a bullet on that, but we don't quite know yet. They haven't moved rates really, but it seems like there's an awful lot of potential for problems there that could, set things in motion. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, China's definitely going to play a major role in the bust. I was out there on Twitter, certainly, and elsewhere, saying I was pretty confident Evergrande was not the trigger to the bust. It's a precursor of things to come. There's certainly, it's the tip of the iceberg over in China in terms of their, if we talk about leverage in the system, China's the poster boy, because, you know, there is just so much leverage there. They basically, what everybody thought was such a miracle of an economy, I've said for many years, it's not a miracle. It's all about the debt, you know, all about the leverage in their system. They've just, you know, leveraged it up far beyond anybody in history. And that's going to come back to haunt us. That is one of probably the major factors in the bust. And I do think their property sector, Evergrande is just the beginning of it, is going to be a big problem, and it will spill over into the world economy. So China is definitely a problem. I think it's not a problem in the next 3 months. So it's, you know, yeah, as we get to the middle of next year, you better start worrying about it, maybe sooner. Yeah. But I think certainly into the first quarter, and probably through the first quarter, the likelihood is that, you know, they can kind of manage things as they always do.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Your view of the coming bust, then, and you also said this, that it would be precipitated by an overreaction in rate tightening, and then would be followed by a flood, an even bigger flood of liquidity into the system than what we saw during COVID, which is kind of hard to fathom. And you're sticking to that?
Yeah, I'm sticking to that. And I think it's by a country mile that it's bigger.
Wow.
You know, I've said, you know, we've grown the balance sheet from what, 3.7 to $8.5 trillion here in the States, and the other central banks have done a lot. I would not be surprised to see the Fed balance sheet on the other side of the bust at something over $20 trillion, maybe approaching $30 trillion. And the reason, and every central bank kind of following suit. So the reason for that is, when this thing starts unwinding, the leverage in the system is huge. You're going to see major bank failures, I believe, probably more concentrated in Europe and Asia than here. You know, Australia's a risk. Canada's a risk today, which it wasn't in 2008. Our bank, surprisingly, because of, or maybe not surprisingly, because of 2008-9, are probably in better shape than most of the world's banks. It doesn't mean we can't have the spillover because of what's going on in the overall global financial system, but it's the massive leverage that, you know, I used to talk about $250 trillion. I think we're up to $300 trillion in global debt now. Man, we just grew another $50 trillion. It's nonsense. I think we throw these numbers around, but there's implications to that. And so we have never, even in 2008, we have never been in a place where we are today in terms of debt and derivatives. And I think that's the, not only the wild card, I think that's the story of this down cycle. Once it gets started, it's going to be very hard until it hits bottom to stop it. And so people can say, well, gee, if the Fed sees the market down 20%, can't they come right in and stop it? You know? No, this thing is going to take on a life of its own because of that leverage. And there, you know, they're going to have a problem because, like I said, inflation doesn't roll over the minute you start tightening. They're going to have the problem of, what do we choose to address? We've got inflation roaring away, and we've got the economy starting to come unwound. If we choose to stop tightening too soon, inflation is just going to be even a bigger problem, and we have to tighten even more. If we choose to address, you know, and of course early on they're going to think the economy can handle itself. If we step in too soon to address the economy, inflation goes. If we address inflation, the economy is going to go south in a hurry because of that leverage. So it's leverage and fragility. I think people may not really be focused because we came out of that March 2020, you know, second quarter swoon so fast. people may not really be focused on how many imbalances there still are, you know, not only in the U.S. economy, but around the world. Statistically, it looks great. You know, we've come back so strong, but there's so many problems out there because of what the pandemic caused. Lots of landlords haven't received their rents for 18 months, you know, or lots of people can barely, you know, afford their homes without government, you know, help. So it's a lot of that kind of stuff.
But you do think that the central banks will err on the side of creating too much inflation rather than cutting the growth?
Yeah, probably the easiest part of my prediction is the fact that is what the response will be. They won't have a choice. What other tool is there? Because this stuff comes, you know, 2008-09 is a good example of how fast the unwind comes once it starts, you know, late September, early October of 2008. And in 6 months' time, we, you know, remember, I mean, it bottomed in March, but remember what the attitudes were coming into that bottom. The world's ending, you know, the thing's just beginning. So things go dire pretty fast. And the Fed has only one tool that can move that quickly, as do all the central banks, and that's QE. So you will see, you'll also see matching that QE, you know, pretty much dollar for dollar fiscal stimulus. So it's March of 2020 on steroids, basically.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, it's multiple steroids.
Yeah, frightening stuff indeed. This all begs the question, and maybe you have some thoughts on this. When you do have inflation, what assets can investors actually allocate to that will protect them? Gold has kind of been maybe one obvious one, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. And I will say this is kind of a two-step process, and I'm not talking trading, but just from the standpoint of the way these assets are going to move. You're at the end of a cycle, as I say, probably end this cycle in the first half of next year. Yes, inflation is breaking out, but it's not I keep hearing about the commodity super cycle. There is a commodity super cycle that's maybe, you know, we saw the bottom in commodities, you know, many, many months ago. But it's not going to be a straight line from here to the other side of the bus in commodities. They're going to get hit very hard in the bus. So those that are owning commodities today, at least own them. If you want to own them through the bust, at least own knowing that the volatility is going to be very large. Once we get through the bust, you know, so that I even think we will, as I've said for many years, I think when the bust hits, it's going to be a deflationary bust. Very short one, but I think we'll go from this inflation problem because of the unwind financially and economically. You'll see a very short-term deflationary period. Won't last more than a year or less, but you know, assets will be hit very hard and values, commodity prices will drop very sharply. And you know, overall, you could see the inflation indexes go negative. But on the other side, you know, you're going to have all this money and fiscal expansion will trigger an inflation cycle like we haven't seen since the 1970s, early 80s. So I'm predicting by the end of the decade, you will have retraced the entire disinflation slash deflation move, and we'll be back at the levels of the early 80s, 20% inflation, 15% long bond. In that environment, the asset that will be the top assets will be commodities and industrial stocks. We haven't seen that other than in little pockets in 40 years. But this will be much like the late 70s, early 80s. Those will be the leaders. That means oil. Now, like I said, oil can get down into the 20s in the bust, but I believe oil will probably be north of $400 by the end of the decade. You know, gold, you know, I'm calling for $2,500 before the bust, you know, so in the next several months, I think it can fall probably back to here in the bus, not a lot lower than this. And then in the next recovery cycle can go to 10,000 and maybe even 20,000, who knows, by the end of the decade. So those are the kind of things. Copper is, I'll use the futures prices, 4.25 now, let's say. I think it can get to $6 in the first half of next year. And then I think it probably heads down towards $2 in the bust. In the recovery cycle, I'm not sure if $20 is a high enough target.
Wow.
So you're going to see prices in commodities like we've never seen. And it creates problems, obviously, in some respects for other areas. But I will tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that commodities will be one of the big leaders of the next cycle, and that growth stocks will suffer greatly because of the headwind of facing interest rates going from the 10-year might get to zero in the bust. I think it will get to 15% by the end of the decade. If you go from zero to 15 over 7 or 8 years, try to buy a growth stock in that environment.
Yeah, right. Yeah. More importantly, you could just put your money in savings if you're getting 10, 15%. I mean, although maybe it won't keep in with pace with inflation, but still.
You will. Yeah, you will. And that's a good segue into bonds, because you will see that what has paid off for people in the last 40 years, certainly, and with some ups and downs along the way, is that owning a long bond when it was yielding 15 and just holding on to it until now, obviously was a huge, you didn't have to trade it. You had a long time where you made multiples. The next cycle will be the opposite. And if you held T-bills for the last 40 years, you didn't make anything.
Yeah.
It just kept, every time you rolled it for less interest. It's going to be the opposite in the cycle that follows the bust. You're going to want to be as short of in your portfolio as possible. And your long bond is going to continue to deteriorate through the cycle, So it takes a whole different mindset. And obviously, same is true in the corporate sector, the shorter, the better. You won't want to reach out the risk curve and own junk. You're going to want to be in the safest stuff. Certainly going into the bust, that's true. Mm-hmm. But even in the next cycle, you're going to have to, at least in the first few years of the cycle, have to kind of watch yourself in terms of your credits. So it's going to be a very different world.
Oh, all right. Well, you gave us a lot to unpack there, David. Thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Again, maybe in closing, just remind our listeners and viewers where they can find out more about you and about your service.
Sure. I'm on Twitter most every day, so they can find me there. My Twitter handle is @DaveHContrarian. I'm usually there. I sometimes respond to people, sometimes don't, but I'm there tweeting. And then I do write a quarterly letter that is all macro based. And if people have any interest in that, the best way to find out about it is to direct message me on Twitter and I will send you details. It's a letter by subscription, so it's not a freebie. And not everybody is not for everybody, but for those that are interested, just send me a direct message and I will get right back to you.
Cool. Awesome. And reminder that if you subscribe to this service, you do not get David. He has his own service. There's been some errors. I don't know if it was miscommunicated, but if people subscribing and asking where you are and you're only a guest, you are not the whole podcast, but
yeah, I think some of the confusion probably also is because you're contrarian investor.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
And I'm, my letter is contrarian value advisor. So,
right.
So I think people may mistake that we're not one and the same.
Correct.
Contrary.
Yes. Yes. And it's a popular thing. Cool. Awesome. Well, with that, we thank you all for listening. And thanks again to David for coming on. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.